Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host today, Monica Hadley. Our guest on Writer's Voices is David Robleski. He is the author most recently of the novel Familiaris, which is his follow-up to the internationally best-selling The Story of Edgar Sawtelle. And I'm pretty sure this new one is probably already hitting the bestseller list. Both of them were Oprah Book Club picks. And The Story of Edgar Sawtelle also was Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writer Selection, winner of the Colorado Book Award, Indie Choice Best Author Discovery Award, and many more. David received an MFA in creative writing from the Warren Wilson MFA Program for Writers and a bachelor's degree in computer science from the University of Wisconsin. He lives in Colorado with the writer Kimberly McClintock and their dogs, Pi and Lucy. Welcome to Writer's Voices, David.
Oh, thanks. Happy to be here.
So you have had great success as an author, and yet you've only published two books. So tell me a little bit about that.
Success is a is there's a lot packed into that word. I'm a journeyman writer. That's the way I think about myself. A never-ending student of the craft. I wrote Edgar as well. Let's put it this way. I started on Edgar in 1995. Immediately realized that although I'd been reading novels all my life and thought I understood how they worked, the moment I had to actually try and create one, I didn't understand anything about the way they worked. Ended up ultimately, after trying and failing, flailing around for a long time, I ended up enrolling in the MFA program at Warren Wilson, which was just an amazing experience. Came out of that and assumed that Edgar was a beginner's novel, one of those novels that's destined to be in a desk drawer forever. And I was fine with that. So I was a little surprised that I got published at all. I didn't expect it. Of course, everyone hopes for it, but you know, you don't expect it. I defined success at that point as somebody was willing to publish it. Right? It was the first novel. So what, you know, I think it gets in the way to worry about publication and quote unquote success or readership or anything like that. I lock up. It's just like a full body tetanus if I start thinking about that stuff. So at that point, I declared success. Like, somebody will publish this. It'll probably sell a few thousand copies, and I was proud of it. Everything that happens after a book gets published is completely out of your hands. I don't really believe that there's any way to influence what's going to happen. I think publishers have, you know, they have an advertising budget and so on, but that is dwarfed by the sort of title influences of readers' interests. So it became a bestseller. And it had gone through its natural life cycle. And it was sort of coming down, the far side of that slope when Oprah picked it. That was a total shock.
Do you know how or why?
No, as far as I know, no one knows except for Oprah and the people who work with her. What I do think, we can talk about that, if you want to get into it, but, no, I have no idea how they pick. You know, that was a year and a half, 2 year long ride, because, you know, once a book gets that kind of attention, you spend a lot of time, being its, its butler. You're there to service, to do service for it in the world. So when I started on Familiaris, I really felt like I was starting from scratch because I'd only done it once. And I actually feel that way now. I've only done it twice. So how Familiaris ended up being picked for Oprah's Book Club again, I don't know any better this time than last time. I'm I'm absolutely grateful for it, of course. I think she's done an amazing thing over the course of whatever, 30 years, 106 books. So that's great. But, as far as to just to sort of bring it back to your question, as far as success goes, I'm not sure. I'm not even sure what constitutes success, except really superficial measures of book sales, which are great. I mean, no problem with that. But I think it's also important as a writer not to measure yourself on that, because whether that happens or not isn't under your control. So you have to define success on some other basis. And the basis that I try and work from is craft.
That's an excellent point, and probably why your books have been successful. Because that's the focus, is craft.
Yeah, maybe. Although it is a mystery, of course, that a lot of really terribly written novels become bestsellers. We know that too.
That is true.
So craft, I don't have any interesting insight onto this. It's a mystery. The relationship between craft and popularity of a book is tenuous, it seems to me. But that's the thing that is under our control as writers.
Right. It is tenuous, but I still believe after, I've been doing these interviews now since 2006, so quite a while, and talking to hundreds of writers, yes. I do believe that quality will succeed eventually.
I gotta believe that too. I don't mean to come across as cynical at all. In fact, I feel like why be a writer if you can't be idealistic about it? Honestly, it's so much work. It's so much work that to do it cynically would be a terrible waste of your life, I think. And on the other hand, to do it in a idealistic way, to believe that good writing not only leads to good results in the world of publication, but it makes you a better person. It teaches you patience. It teaches you perseverance. That has to be the right approach to it all. So I'm sorry if I sounded cynical there. I'm really not.
No, I don't think you were cynical. I think sometimes, to be honest, people aren't always a good judge of the quality of their own writing, obviously.
And so, that works both ways. I've read plenty of stuff that people have said, this is just garbage, but I need another set of eyes on it. And I'll read it and go, this is actually really good.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It does work both ways.
Yeah.
And I do think that, well, I guess this is kind of egotistical. I feel like any writing that I think is good will be successful in the world of publication.
if that's true, that you have the most unique intuition in the world. One of the things that I came to understand through my first experience publishing is that even publishers don't know what's going to work, because if publishers knew what was going to work, they'd only publish the ones that were going to be successful.
That is true.
So,
and it's not like I like every best-selling book. Obviously I don't. So it doesn't work in the reverse, but I feel like if I think this is really well written, that other people are going to agree with me.
You know what? The way it works for me is when I run into a book that I think is well written, there's some part of me that is just cheering for it, and I'm not in a position to change its fate at all as a reader, but I feel that I can at least give it some karmic a little karmic push by going, yes, amazing job. I understand how hard this was to do. I understand what an artistic accomplishment it is. I cross all my fingers for the book, and I want it to succeed.
So, David, what drew you to the story of Edgar Sawtelle? Why did you write that particular book? And maybe give a little bit of an idea of what that book is about, because Familiaris is a, what would you call it, a precursor? You know, you went back in time in the Sawtell family, so they're related books. So you've been in this world
for a long time.
For a long time.
I'm on a war against the and it's a losing war. I know I will lose, but it's okay. I'm on a war against the word prequel, which I think is one of the ugliest words ever constructed. One of the
prequel. Yeah, I said no, precursor, maybe, but which may not be any better.
No, the precursor is much better. I have insisted that my publisher just say follow up so that they don't lapse into the use of the word prequel. In any case, one reason why I object to it is because it somehow suggests that you have to read them in one order or another. But I worked really hard to make sure that you could read them Familiaris first or Edgar first. It doesn't matter. Either one, they're more like interlocking stories than they are a sequence. But anyway, that's aside from your main question. The most truthful answer to, you know, why that story is because it's the story that occupied my imagination. I've had this only happen once or twice in my life, where an idea just sort of came to me, and that's what happened with Edgar. Is I was very familiar with a couple of Shakespeare's plays, Hamlet being one of them. I was a theater major for about 15 minutes when I was when I was in college.
And then you switched to the more practical computer science.
that's a story in and of itself. But what I discovered in the more general terms was, you know, there's two basic kinds of creative expression. One is performative, and one is I don't know what you'd say, like constructive. It's making. So I discovered, well, first of all, I'm a terrible actor, and I was always going to be a terrible actor. I suppose I could have been an okay actor. I didn't know what I was doing. I was 18 years old. So, but I happened to be around people who were incredibly talented and just luminesced when they walked on stage. And I understood that. And I said, but I was very interested in this, in the plays themselves. I would read the plays and go, wow, how did they write this? It's an amazing thing that they've written. So I was obviously interested in the writing more than the performing. And I happened to, at that very time, write my first computer program. I just copied it out of a manual. This is the other moment that this has happened to me, that the light just went on, like, oh, I get this. I understand what we're doing here. We're building stuff out of language, out of pure language. And what happened with Edgar is, I had thought it would be interesting to try and write a novel just for fun. I don't know why I want to do that, but, you know, I'm sure I can just put a few weekends into it and knock one out. Why, what the heck? and that went very poorly. I sort of set aside. And one day I remember I was actually working in my living room, and in the course of about 90 seconds, this idea just kind of popped into my head, which was, what if you could retell the story of Hamlet, on a farm? And I knew a farm because I'd grown up on a farm. So why don't I just evacuate all the people who really lived there and put in all new people? Denmark and the castle, you know, in Elsinore is not all that different from a farm. It's just a couple of buildings. Everything is out there. Hamlet has a very small cast. In reality, it's just a few people. You know, family farms have a few people living on them. There's a sense of remoteness in Hamlet. So all these things fell into place. And I was also interested in writing about dogs, because I'd grown up about dogs. So in the course of really a very short period of time, this sort of idea came, and I understood how it parsed out against a five-act structure. And then the very next thing I understood, like on second 91, was I had no, I did not have the ability to write such a story. That was way too ambitious. And so it took me, well, until 2008, that's whatever that is, 13 years, 14 years, to teach myself what I needed to do in order to actually be able to write that, to go to school, to study, to start reading differently, and so on. And it just turned out to be, in the end, a productive place for a story to play out. And it could have gone otherwise. It could have been a bad idea, and but you have to do it to find out, right? You have to try and experiment with it and go, oh, this is going somewhere, as opposed to, oh, this isn't going somewhere.
Okay, so I did not realize that Hamlet was your inspiration. So trying to one-up Shakespeare, that's a pretty ambitious start.
Well, one-up is, I think, the wrong way to think about it. I, you know, as a beginning writer, the way I looked at it is, I need some crutches to lean on. Mm. I'm not going to, you know, the idea of writing a novel that had nothing to do with my life, that had nothing to do with anything I understood, that came in whole cloth in an entirely different world, seemed utterly impossible. But one of the plays that I was in my short acting career was West Side Story, which is a retelling of Romeo and Juliet, right?
Right, right.
So an idea that had always been in my mind was that you can retell old stories, and it doesn't it's not a copy. It's an interpretation of something that is deeper than that story.
Well, I mean, Shakespeare only used a handful of plots, and none of them were right. Original either.
Exactly. Although I didn't know it at the time, I did, you know, eventually find out that Hamlet, of course, was based on a story that's often called the Hamlet, which was as old in Shakespeare's time as Hamlet is for us. It had been around for hundreds of years. So he was retelling stories too, right? But that, for me, that was just that's a like post facto justification. what was going on is the idea of writing a novel that was completely where everything was made up and I had nothing to start with was too daunting. But if I had a place I knew and I had a basic story structure that I could improvise around, that gave me enough material to begin the experimentation to find out whether it was going to be a worthwhile thing to pursue.
Well, you certainly hit the ball out of the park on that, because it feels so original.
Well, that's of course that's what you hope, that it's distant enough from the source material that even if you know what the source material is, that's not a spoiler for you.
Yeah.
But again, I you know, the way I approach all this is it's an experiment, and at any point the experiment can fail, right up to the point of publication, right up to the point where somebody opens the book and goes, as happens to me many times, I've read five pages. This isn't the book for me right now. I know it's a good book, but it's not the book for me right now. And it goes on the shelf, and someday I pick it up and go, why did I wait? So it's it's just an experiment all the way along.
It's interesting because were you familiar with Jane Smiley's A Thousand Acres?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. Because that is also taking Shakespeare and putting it on a Midwest farm.
That's Lear, right.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Right. And of course, it's a magnificent novel. And it had already been published when I started working on Edgar. And then I discovered it and read it and was only more daunted by the whole thing. I mean, after you read a book like that, you just kind of go, well, how are you going to beat that? The one thing that I had going for me was I wanted to take a really different approach to the material. She took a very realist kind of approach to that story and did it magnificently. I built into Hamlet is some degree of supernatural stuff.
Right.
There is, I kind of consider it the Elizabethan version of science fiction. There's a poison involved in Hamlet that the description of when the ghost appears for Hamlet and describes how he was killed and pouring the poison into the porches of his ears and the whole description of what that was like was so evocative to me, but it comes across like kind of like science fiction. Like back in that day, that was science fiction. Like, oh my God, that could actually happen. And then what's left over is you don't just die. There's this residue in the world of a ghost. It still blows my mind. The basic conceit is just amazing. So I knew I wanted to sort of bear down on that aspect of it a little more. That gave me enough courage to not go, well, this has already been done. I give up.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is David Robleski, author of Familiaris, which is, the title comes from the Latin name for dog, right?
Sure does, yes.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of words buried in that word, family and familiar. And those things all also unfold. But it's a book about people's relationships to dogs, among other things. It takes a while to get there, but it does.
Yes. How important are the dogs in this book?
I think they're the relationship between people and dogs, which is astonishing to me. It goes back tens of thousands of years. Long enough that I did the calculation once. I think it's 1,000 human generations that we've been living with dogs, give or take, and it's changed us at a DNA level. I mean, that's not an exaggeration, and it's obviously changed dogs at a DNA level. We co-evolved with dogs, and to me, that's such a unique and amazing thing that I. In some way, I wanted that, the nature of that deep, deep connection to be the centerpiece of the book. And I had to start in a slightly different spot, because you can't just go where you want to end up. You have to start somewhere else. So the story begins not centered on dogs, but becomes a story about someone trying to decide what he wants to do with his life. And ultimately that entails working with dogs.
Okay, I have a question for you. A dachshund and a Saint Bernard are so different. How is it that we all can look at both of those and say that's a dog?
Isn't that amazing?
Yes.
As my understanding is that dogs are the most physically varied mammal on Earth. I can't remember where I ran across this fact, but you know, you put a Chihuahua next to a Great Dane, and you go, how can these be the same species? But they are.
Yeah.
By whatever definition of species you want to pick, they are the same species.
And how do we recognize that?
At a biological level, it's the mechanism is that they happen to have certain genes that are especially elastic in terms of physical form, that really are easily varied, unlike other animals. Like we don't have house cats that can be as big as a Doberman and as small as a Chihuahua. And that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, it probably is. You had your first book, The Story of Edgar Sawtelle. Did you start writing Familiaris immediately after that?
Well, Edgar was published in 2008, and I think it was about a year before I seriously started on Familiaris, because I was I'm the kind of person who I really am a single tasker. I really cannot split my time. And particularly doing like bookstore readings and other events impinge on my ability to concentrate enormously. if I have to go give do some public speaking, it doesn't just interrupt my sort of creative flow for that day. It's more like a week.
Oh, wow.
To sort of get back into the place where I need to be. I can do superficial stuff, but the deep work of writing first draft and envisioning a story, I need days and days of my ordinary routine, not necessarily quiet, but my ordinary routine. So that first year, I didn't try very hard because I knew it wasn't going to work.
So do you write full time or do you have a day job too?
I do write full time now, which is let me put it this way. It has not been good news to discover that the words writing full time doesn't mean writing 8 hours a day. I always felt like it was a shortcoming of mine that after 2 or 3 hours of writing first draft, I was done. I was tapped out. And when I've had a chance to talk to other writers, that's one of the things I asked them, like, how many hours a day can you actually work when you're doing first draft? And the answer has almost always been 2 to 3 hours. If I'm working hard, 2 to 3 hours, and then I'm shot. The well is dry for that day. And so, you know, before I was writing full time, a couple of times I took periods of time off, a leave of absence for a month or two from my job, and had this very unhappy discovery, which is I was all charged up. I would get to my desk by 6 in the morning. I'm like, okay, I'm really going to hit it today. And then by 9 in the morning, I was done. And I would think, I could have just gone to work. Why did I take time off without pay to do this? And surely this will change. And it never has. That's about what I've got in a given day. Revision, middle drafts, final drafts, that's a different story.
Okay.
But first draft, 2 or 3 hours a day.
So you may as well be working while you're doing your first draft and then take the time off for the revisions.
Yeah. And the experiment that Kimberly and I decided to do when Edgar got published and it was successful enough to bring in one big gulp of money, which is obviously that's the way income works for writers, is you don't have a steady income. When you publish, you go through a period of high royalties, high relative to what, you know, whatever measure you have. And then it tails off and you're in the long tail from then on. And we had, you know, we said, okay, we've got enough of, enough money has come in and we have enough saved to have enough runway to write another book and full time. And we want to know what that experience is like. And I thought it would take 5 years. In the absolute worst case, that it would take 7 years. And of course it took 15 years because how can you predict these things? I'd read one book. So why I thought I would know how long it would take to write another book, I don't know.
So in your acknowledgments in Familiaris, you talk about Kimberly working side by side with you on the revision. So what is your work process like and how is she involved in it?
The way it works is for both of us is we write our first drafts and work them through until we think that it's not going to be embarrassing to show it to the other person. So early drafts, nobody sees but us. And the few times that we vary from that routine, it's been obvious that we shouldn't have. I tend to want to get a big section of a book done to a point where I think it will give her pleasure to read it. It's not right, quote unquote, but it's not a painful experience to read. that's the hard part. The fun part from then on is that we is sitting down and talking with her. And since we're both writers, we can play the games that writers play. We can, and we will sit side by side in front of the text editor and start playing with the words. as once we agree that the structure is right, and there are plenty of times when she'll say, this is just boring, or I think this is out of order, or you should rearrange it, and we'll talk about that, and I'll go away and do that. But once the structure is something that I think is right, we will sit down and together in front of the text editor and start playing. And it's just immense fun, because that's where, to me, that's where all the joy in writing comes from, is actually playing with sentences and paragraphs. And we've done the same thing for each other, which is we see textual possibilities that the other person doesn't see. So Kimberly will say to me, why don't you cut the last paragraph of this scene and end it here instead of here? And instead of just speculating on that, we just try it. And then we look at it right there in real time and go, oh, that's a terrible mistake. Or, oh, God, that was a great idea. She has time and again done this trick that I don't know how she does it. She'll say, see these two paragraphs? Reverse the order of those two paragraphs. And I'll say, that could never work. They were written in that order because they have to be in that order. So look, I'll do it just to satisfy you. And oh my God, that is so much better. And we're laughing. I mean, this is, you're laughing, but that's what happens to us. We start laughing.
Wow.
It's really fun to work on dialogue scenes with her, because one of us will read, the other will listen, and we'll trade off. And tuning up dialogue together like that is just a blast. It's just plain fun. It's play. It's play.
Now, is she a novel writer also?
She was. We met at the Warren Wilson program. She is a. She was on the poetry track, and it has her degree. They don't differentiate the degrees, but her whole course of study there was poetry. She has subsequently moved into writing essays, and she's writing these wonderful essays right now. She has a novel that she wrote. I think it's really interesting and good. She felt like it was no fun to work on, and so right now it's shelved and in favor of working on essays.
Now, you don't have any novels in a drawer, do you?
No. What I have are hundreds of drafts of two novels in a drawer. My writing process is not linear. It is predicated on the idea that in order to come up with something that is the optimal instantiation of what you want to make, you have to explore all you know, the nearby alternatives at the very least.
Okay.
So I do a lot of exploratory writing. There are at least as many pages not in Familiaris as were in Familiaris or are in Familiaris. So
now, do you write totally on computer?
I would say 90% of the writing I do is on computer. That's the way I'm fastest, but I love to use a typewriter now and then. I like the physical violence of smashing keys down onto paper once in a while. That's fine.
You said that, I got to say, I flashed to this scene of, or I flashed to this idea of Ernest Hemingway standing at his desk, smashing his thing. And then I flashed to, in Familiaris, where John wants to write in the same type of blue notebook that Ernest Hemingway wrote in.
Yes, yes, yes. Which fails. There's a part in the book where John is trying to write a book, and the title of the book is Familiaris. He tries many things that turn out not to. He's very concerned with having the right pencil sharpener and all the various other things that distract us as writers that become these totems. Like, I have to have the right pencil sharpener. It has to be for him. It has to be mounted in the right place. I find when you're writing in volume, it's fun to work in different media at different times. It breaks the monotony and makes it feel fresh. So I also have about 8 or 9 different computer keyboards that I will switch between just to keep
interesting.
Just to keep it, you know, and I don't need to. It's just to keep it fun, make it feel tactilely different. I rearrange my office furniture all the time. All my office furniture, all my desks are on sliders and stand sliders. I slide them around in the room. I have everything mounted on the desk so that all I just need to do is slide it somewhere else and plug it in. Because I like the variety. Monotony, I think, is a real danger.
Wow. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is David Robleski, author of Familiaris. David, why don't you read a little bit from Familiaris for us?
Sure. This is a short scene. It occurs in the very beginning of the novel, maybe 30 pages or so in. The main characters, the two main characters in the book are John Sawtelle and his wife Mary, and this is just a scene that describes how they met and first fell in love. What I'm skipping over here is a little bit of backstory, but this is where their courtship begins in earnest. On a warm Saturday afternoon, that first May in Hartford, John walked over to the Woolworths on Main Street to buy socks. He'd lingered afterward, looking at shirts and suspenders, when an elderly farm woman, leaning heavily on a cane, went thumping past up the central aisle. A young woman followed her, clasping in her arms two enormous bundles of yarn and fabric and pinching between her fingers a half dozen dress patterns and a bag of notions. The young woman was dressed in a neat, practical, short-sleeved blouse and a blue skirt, and her dark hair was gathered atop her head in an offhand Gibson girl bun, though a few sun-bronze strands had escaped and loosely framed her face, her extraordinarily lovely face. As they passed, a skein of yellow yarn escaped from one of the bundles and fell silently to the floor. John snatched up the yarn and followed. Now that he was behind the young woman, her outfit looked less purely practical, and he regretted that the front door was only a few paces ahead. Even struggling to contain the bundles in her arms, the young woman's stride was liquid and athletic. The air behind her smelled like cinnamon and roses, and when she spoke, they were discussing Pancho Villa's recent raid in New Mexico. Her voice was a serene contralto, inflected with patience and irony in a way he'd never heard before. He waited until the last moment, then slipped ahead to hold the door for the women. Outside, he loaded the packages into the matron's wagon, along with the rescued daffodil yarn, then presented a steadying arm as the old woman ascended to the buckboard. Only after she'd taken the reins did he understand that the young woman wasn't joining her, wasn't a granddaughter or grandniece, but a store employee. Here was tremendous news. She lived in town. He already knew he was in love. It would be years before he learned that the dropped yarn was no accident. It was astonishing how often a person needed to visit Woolworths. By the following Saturday, he'd learned her name, Mary Svoboda. By the Saturday after that, they'd gone walking. They were the same age. She'd grown up in Hartford. By June, they'd kissed. He'd had sweethearts before, but compared to Mary Svoboda, they might as well have been goldfish. Her way of speaking was wry and serious, without over-earnestness or indifference. She was plain-spoken about what she liked and disliked, what mystified her, what she hoped for in life. She had a nonchalant contempt for Midwestern parochialism, which she did not believe was a particular specialty of small towns. At the scent of hypocrisy, which she considered a form of betrayal, she was capable of offhanded, sarcastic coloratura that brought to mind a lioness licking her claws after a kill. She didn't mind other people's children, but had no intention of bearing children of her own. She considered the war in Europe a travesty. She wasn't afraid of hard work, and she didn't think manual labor was ignoble. She was neither religious nor a freethinker, both poisoned by dogma. She thought capital M marriage was a dead institution, but Small M marriage was not, if he knew what she meant. He wasn't sure he did. A marriage license was hardly a ticket to lifelong romantic love, she clarified, but free love was at least as fraught and, generally speaking, impractical. Successful unions necessarily involved a facade of conventionality, pitched like a painted tent over a granite outcrop of skeptical love, unconventional love, love that made real demands and welcomed the same in return. Nothing daunted her. She seemed calmly proficient at everything life called upon her to do. Though she didn't easily laugh, she often looked amused. She walked with a lissome felinity. Her eyes were amber jewels. All of it was instantly engraved upon John. He wondered how powdered sugar would taste, licked off the nape of her neck. Toward the end of June, the weather warm and the sun like syrup poured across the person's shoulders, Mary invited him to come sit with her on the front porch of 736 Elm Street, where she lived with her stepfather, a man she referred to as the Beast, or sometimes Beastie, not a term of affection. She considered the Beast to be the earthly manifestation of bullshit. And though years would pass before John understood the deepest basis for her disdain, its range was quickly evident. At low ebb, a simple, bored disfavor. At high tide, a contempt so razorous that just standing near its object shaved a layer off one's skin. The Beast, known to the world as Alphonse Svoboda, fancied himself a colossus of the New World sort, Rooseveltian and Bootstrappian. He spoke not to a person, but to an audience of one, and his stories portrayed a man bestriding the vast agricultural industrial Midwest, wholly self-made, worldly, canny, adventurous, capable of heights of idealism one instant and bare-knuckled negotiation the next, a human electromagnet, reorienting the iron filings in the souls of his fellow men. Autobiography tended to erupt from the Beast in the evenings, when his constitutional bourbon was in full circulation, and thus evenings were when Mary was liable to point out to the Beast that his aspect was more Taftian than Rooseveltian, the likely source of any detectable awe among the populace. Also, that what he was a cash register salesman. In his Roosevelt fetish, Alphonse Svoboda had barbered his mustache down from the waxed handlebar of his youth, visible in photographic portraits hanging on the wall in oval frames, to a brushy walrus, and had taken to wearing an unnecessary pair of oval eyeglasses. He'd even purchased a slouch hat, so-called, the left side pinned up Rough Rider style, which he donned at an angle meant to convey rugged jauntiness. What Mary hadn't told John, at least at first, was that to her, the Beast's most distinguishing feature wasn't his Jovian dimensions, but the small white scar protruding from the hairline above his right ear, the brand he bore from his first and only attempt to lay a hand on her.
And that was David Robleski reading from Familiaris. So, David, you have these, you have John and Mary and Elbow and Frank and Sojak and Walter and Ida. How many of those characters did you have in mind when you started writing?
That is such an excellent question. I knew that the story was going to be, at least in one way, a love story, a lifelong love story between John and Mary. And I knew it was going to cover a certain amount of time. And I knew a couple of things about John from having written Edgar. He gets introduced in Edgar as having been born with an extra share of whimsy. And I took that to be his initial, if there was a kernel quality of John, it was that. And for whatever reason, I knew that he had a best friend whose name was Elbow. But beyond that, and beyond my general intuition that about the general direction it was going to go in, I didn't know much else. So Sojak and Granddaddy, the Granddaddy, the big draft horse that's in the book, and his keeper, and Frank Eckling were were nowhere on my radar whatsoever. And, you know, part of the fun of writing is discovering these things. I don't create detailed outlines. I have a sense of where I want it to go, a general shape that I'm trying to fill out. But I don't outline things in advance. I think that would be incredibly boring. It would take all the fun out of things for me. So as I'm writing along, things are happening, and I'm a few minutes ahead of what's on the page, but not that far.
Often. You're writing to discover what happens.
Yeah. And one of the things that was true is John is a dreamer. John has a lot of ideas. There's a moment early in the book where he gets drunk and starts spinning out all his ideas of what the future is going to be like. And you know, basically without breaking a sweat, he comes up with 20 or 30 ideas about what the future is going to be like. That's what he's like. That's what it's like inside his head. Almost all of them are kind of half crazy or weird or straight up just laughable. A couple of them are good and true and right. But there was nobody in the story who was challenging him and calling bullshit on him. and I thought, there needs to be one other person, because Elbow's quality, his best friend Elbow's quality, is that he's virtually silent. He doesn't like to talk. He's incredibly competent and he does all kinds of amazing things, but he doesn't like to talk. And John's a blabbermouth. He just yaks and yaks and yaks, which was, by the way, one of the other things I knew about John. I just finished, you know, Edgar is mute in the story of Edgar Sawtelle. Maybe in part because I'm so daunted by writing dialogue. So oh. I said, you know, in the next book, the main character has to be an over talker. He's got to verbally process things to the extreme. So Elbow was in no position to say, you know, that's nonsense. And Mary, who's very different than John and very practical, as the passage that I just read, I hope, illustrated. But she compliments him and looks past that. There's nobody to say, oh, your ideas are stupid and crazy and dumb. And unplanned by me and unexpected, this new character named Frank Eckling came in, who is a former friend of John's and turns out disillusioned, let's say, about John's big ideas, and decides to accompany them on this big adventure that they're going on specifically to see John fail, because he's there to puncture John's pretenses at every turn. And it changed the nature of the novel entirely when that happened, in a way I could never have predicted.
Wow. One of the other kind of, I don't know, underlying themes, or not exactly theme, but is this idea of a house or a building as almost a living thing. Mm-hmm. So where did that come from, and what were you trying to convey?
I'm trying to think of how to answer that in a way that is even remotely concise. My career as a software researcher that preceded all the writing, one of the things that I was very interested in is the sort of way that people and their tools have to work together. I worked with a lot of cognitive scientists and linguists, and the subject of their study is how do people work with their tools? And one of the tools is the very space that you work in, is a sort of fundamental tool, and how the way you arrange things is a sort of a way of externalizing a bunch of mental work that you have to do. So I kind of came to the book with this deep belief that the way you organize your work world is sort of an external manifestation of the way you think and by extension, the way you live. Or in reverse, if you want to be a writer, you have to live right. And part of that is the space that you're in. So I made that an interest of Mary's. And I'll just add in one other ingredient here. In the software world, people got interested in an architect, and his name is Christopher Alexander. He wrote a couple of, in the 70s, he wrote a couple of big volumes of sort of not exactly architectural theory, but a way of thinking about design in general. He talked very convincingly in his books about the profound relationship between the quality of your life and the shape of your space, as you might expect an architect to talk about it. And that has had, weirdly, that has had a huge influence in the world of software design. His idea about how to write down a design has been adopted widely in the world of software. You wouldn't have predicted it, but in retrospect, it seems almost inevitable. And he decided that the right way to write down design knowledge for other people is using a system that he called patterns. So he wrote a book called A Pattern Language. So all that are the sort of basic ingredients, but again, those are starting points. I gave these interests to Mary, and I basically said, run with this, see where you go. And so one of her abiding interests in the book is making a place where they can, that sort of harbors their creative life safely. And she sees they move to this abandoned farm, and she sees that as a blank canvas that she can work with.
So are any of the characters inspired by someone in particular?
There's the characters are in some way or another all inspired by real people, but there's no one-to-one match. The way I think about it is my job is to steal moments and attributes of people and and remix them into different combinations that suit my purposes. So I cannot point to one person and say that's this person. That's I know is not true. But on the other hand, I have had the great good luck of working with a number of brilliant people that I find personally inspiring. They've been examples to me of integrity, of craftsman, of, you know, executing on the ideal of craftsmanship, of having like very dimensional lives. Some of them are very funny. Some of them are extremely creative. And I took all those, I sort of put all that together. And, you know, probably chief among those people is Kimberly McClintock, who I find inspiring as a partner and as a friend and a playmate. And those all went into the bucket, and I pulled qualities out and remixed them as I saw fit.
So, and which of the characters is most you?
I think probably John. I'd like to deny that, and because I'd like to, you know, say that my imagination is completely uncoupled from, you know, who I am as a person, and I share John's optimism, and when as the book went along, I think he became more and more like me. He's not like me in a number of ways, but I have to admit that there's some pretty significant overlap between us.
Now, the book is set in northern Wisconsin. I'm guessing that's a very familiar area to you. Are there, like, is the farm, or is there a specific location that you're having in mind when you write about the farm and the two towns that they live? Are they real towns? These Hartford?
Yeah, one of them is.
Yeah.
Hartford is a real town.
Okay.
It is where the Kissel Automotive Company had its manufacturing headquarters.
Oh, that's a real company.
That's a real company, and the Louis Kissel, one of the early episodes in the book is that Louis Kissel, who is the sort of patriarch of the and founder of the company, is shot by a man. Nobody knows quite why, but I just, in researching the Kissel Automotive Company, actually with my sister, we were down visiting the, there's an automotive museum in Hartford. We were visiting it, and she said, and she was looking through some newspaper articles that were on display, and she said, "Do you know about this?" And she called me over, and I read about the incident, and I said, "Oh, that's exactly what I need to start this book." So, so Hartford's a real place. Mellon, on the north side of the state, is a real place. The truth is probably that if I had thought that Edgar was going to be published, I would have renamed it into some fictional version. But I didn't think it was going to be published, so I didn't bother to rename it. And then when it was published, I didn't really believe it was going to be published. I didn't believe anybody was going to read it, so I didn't bother to rename it. So it is a real place, and it sort of defies convention to give it its real name. And the people in Mellon, I didn't grow up there. I just think it's a lovely town, and it happens to be in the right place in the state. So the people in Mellon, when I first went there to do a reading, the first thing they asked is, "Why here? you have no family here. You didn't grow up here." And I had to say, you know, I just think this is a lovely town, and it is exactly what I imagined the small town that they lived near to be like. There's a very tiny crossroads town called Popcorn Corners, and that is a fictional place, although vaguely modeled after a literal crossroads town about 5 or 6 miles from where I grew up, which had a bar and a grocery store, and I believe it had a butcher.
Yeah, Iowa has those too.
Yeah.
Like there's one nearby called Four Corners.
And yeah.
And there's one up the next county up called Talleyrand. Yeah, just little tiny corner towns, crossroads towns.
Yep.
So, David, I'm not out of questions, but we are out of time. So I'm going to have to thank you.
Better that than the other.
Yeah, for being with us today. We always close with a quote, and so the quote I chose for today is from John Steinbeck: "A dog is a bond between strangers."
Lovely.
Yeah.
Absolutely right.
So thank you so much. And I hope we don't have to wait 15 years for the next book.
We're both hoping for that. Trust me.
Thank you. And
thanks so much.
See you all next week on Writers' Voices.